I've been in program for 13 years now. I came in through because of pain, the end of a relationship and a lot of other things, and I'll get into it in a little bit more detail. How much time do I have?
Take as long as you want.
You asked, just keep going.
So I'll share what I can, and if anybody wants to share afterwards, I'm happy to.
You have four minutes.
You get 10 minutes. So it's not all about baggage and then a little recovery. I was trying to write down a little earlier, you know, the big important parts of my story, especially those that I discovered. There's those that I remember, and then there's also what I ended up rediscovering as the process of the fourth and the fifth step in human life, that are significant. And, you know, as I shared with a couple of my sponsors, you know, they've done the fourth step, is what my sponsor told me is, you know, let's focus on the significant emotional events that went on into your life. And that could be good events or bad events or the significant emotional ones. My earliest memories is, you know, I was born in Mexico City, but early on we moved back to Spain, where that's where my father's from, and those are my earliest memories is in Spain, in Madrid. I remember my father teaching me how to ride a bicycle. This is one of the few memories that I have of him. I remember having a mom and a dad, and I remember everything being fairly normal up to that point. And then there's a big blank. There's a lot of years that are unaccounted for in memories. It happened that when I was 8 years old, my father had a very severe car accident. He was going, you know, he was traveling at a very high rate of speed at the time he and his partner owned a Lamborghini, and they were crossing the Pyrenees in Spain, and they went off the road and crashed, and my father ended up with a very severe head injury, as well as other injuries in his body, but his head injury really did a lot of damage. He was in a coma for about 6 months, and then when he came out, he didn't recognize any of us, didn't know how to write, didn't know how to read, didn't know how to walk, didn't do, had to start all over. So some of that, some of those first memories are of that. It's, and some of these memories came back as a result of doing a lot of step work and a lot of dual work, a lot with my sponsor, because most of them were completely blank. But I do remember when some of the memories came back as feelings of, like, I remember the fear after the accident, like, holy shit. I remember that somebody brought home the steering wheel that was completely charred, and he sat in our living room, and I remember just how terrified I was what had happened. I remember the fear, and then what is going to happen now? Just the being in limbo, and nobody really, I don't remember anybody telling me other than he had an accident and he's fucked up and he's in a hospital in a coma. But I don't remember much of conversation there. No. All I remember was just there was a lot of drama. Other memories that that came back, I remember my mom taking me on a drive numerous times, and we were going out to see somebody. Later on, I realized that she was having an affair with this man, and she never told me, don't say anything, just, it was, I sort of knew, I assumed that I knew what I was not to tell anybody, especially my dad, which was at home, convalescing. Took years for my dad to somewhat get back to a normal life. But I remember that I now had this secret that I had to keep from my dad, and I felt that I was betraying him. And the maybe another year or so that we stayed in Spain, I guess it was decided by my mom, my dad, and the rest of the family that it'd be better if we came back to Mexico and leave my dad in Spain to recover as best as he could, while the other family or the rest of the family in Mexico could help us out to get back on our feet, my mom said. And so that's what we did. I remember coming back to Mexico, returning. And And then my dad, never hearing from him again. There was no more communication, there were no more letters, we never heard from him again. And I remember asking about it, and I remember being told, don't ask anymore. You know, I got a sense that it was not okay to ask about what was going on. I always received it as, you know, to stop questioning what we're doing. And I was feeling the abandonment of having my dad didn't come back. I also had carried the shame that I had betrayed him. And this is how I saw it, that I had betrayed him because I knew about the affair and I didn't tell him. I remember also sometimes during his, at home, being back at home, and again, a little bit more by his history of my dad. My dad was a professional soccer player for a Spanish team, a very well-known team. So for us, he was our idol. He was this grander, you know, this bigger-than-life person. And so we adored him, and we looked up to him, and he was very athletic, and he was just, and that's the dad that I remember. After the accident, he was nothing like that. He was, could not walk, could not, you know, talk, could not read, could not, you know, I had to help him, you know, to follow his eyes. So I remember him, and I remember me being a kid, just screaming, yelling, and running around, and my dad completely losing it. And I thought he was directed at me. I thought he was losing because I was just running, right? And I remember him just dropping on the floor and just crying. And somehow I felt that I had caused some of that. And then I also knew this awful secret that I was withholding from him, because I knew that my mom was having an affair. So these are some of the stuff that went on, some of the feelings that I was feeling back then. Came back to Mexico, came up to my mom's family, my mom's side of the family. This is a family that I didn't really get to know until much later, until I was over the program, that had been affected by alcoholism, but it was from my great-grandfather. He was an abusive alcoholic that everybody feared, and he had abandoned his kids, you know, my grandfather. And so we came home to Spain, to Mexico, to a family that was, you know, a very large family. My mom has 10 brothers and sisters, and lots of cousins, lots and lots of cousins. And everybody's in everybody's business. Everybody, that is the role, you know. Somebody's doing this, they get into it, and everybody would criticize the way my mom was doing this, or my mom would criticize that. And it was a very chaotic, very crazy family. There was a lot of fighting that would go on. Always under the pretense, you know, that this is the right thing to do. Very Catholic family. But at the same time, everybody, you know, a lot of my uncles and aunts had affairs that were going on, and sort of everybody knew, but nobody talked about. So there was this very, my mom had already told me, you know, there was a lot of hypocrisy going on in the family, and my mom was always rebelling. And so, again, this is what is normal for me, or was normal at that time. Everybody talks about everybody, everybody has secrets, don't get caught. Always fear in present, you know, I was always always fearful of what was going on. Never knowing what was going on. I was always trying to, especially anytime there was any sort of conflict, people would disappear. You know, my mom would have conflict with his uncle and they'd never talk to him again. And this is another thing that in our family, and then the Mexican family, I've now learned that it's one of the patterns that exists in our family, that this emotional amputations that went on. When my great-grandfather left these two kids when they were 14 and 15 and just walked away from them and left them there, this is what my grandfather grew up with, and his brother, Domingo. Later on, when my grandfather had a big falling out with his brother, over financial dispute, they never spoke to each other again until they both died. We're talking about probably 25, 30 years of complete emotional amputation. And that was, I guess that we all accepted it. That's, you know, you don't go talk to Domingo, you know, at least don't get caught doing so. Later on, my grandfather also had a falling out with my mom. And this is when we left Mexico to come to the north. Same thing, you know, big you know, there was a lot of control issues on the family side. And so conflicts would arise and there'd be another geographic where we'd not move and we would not see the family again. And there'd be another one of those amputations. And this is something that I learned, that this is just that this is what was normal. You have a falling out and you just screw you, we're out of here, we're gone. And I say this because this has happened later in my life and there are things that I've also done. But this is where I picked it up. This is what was normal. There were instances where I remember I was always seeking some sort of attention from people because I was feeling pretty neglected. My mom was at the time now a single mom living in Mexico City under a government job that was paid very little. So there wasn't much mom around. She'd, you know, leave early in the morning and she wouldn't come back until late in the evening. When she came home, you didn't know what you were going to get. And she might have been drinking or not. She'd like to drink here and there. I wouldn't say she's an alcoholic. But what I do know is her moods. She's bipolar, so her moods were, you know, off the charts sometimes. So I learned to scan and sort of read, and just from the way that the keys would hit the table to the doorstep to the way the door opened, I already knew, and I knew how to scan it and read the signs and know who do I need to be to be safe, because the last thing I wanted is any sort of conflict, because truly I felt like, you know, it could be me then. Could be left, you know. Look what happened with my dad, what happened with my uncle Domingo, look what happened with my mom, you know. Like, to me, I began to gather evidence to, like, yeah. And this is the beginning of when I started to feel that I didn't feel like anybody had my back. This is when I'm starting to feel, you know, and I'm about 11 years old then. And it's time to, okay, you know, like, sort of trust my mom because that's the only thing I got, and my brothers and sisters, but it was frail. There was a lot of moving from one town to another for whatever reason. She had a problem with the landlord. Fuck you, and we're out of there. My teachers at school would talk to my mom and tell her that, you know, I was failing at just about every subject other than art or sports. But my mom did not care for that sort of criticism or observation and told him to fuck off, so we moved to another school. And the same thing would happen over and over. So I never finished, I think I probably finished four grades completely throughout my whole school history, but then I only finished about eight grades, you know, between Spain, Mexico, and the US. And so there was a lot of that. There was a lot of uncertainty, fear, again, begin to scan and learn how to put a facade, a veneer, what needed to be, and fear always present. A few incidents, I remember a couple of incidents, powerful emotional things that where I felt betrayed by my mom, was once I remember being very proud. We were in Mexico City, somebody had come over and fucking stolen we had a Volkswagen bus, a combi, and somebody unscrewed they would steal your mirrors. And my mom went, God damn it, they did it again. And she looked over and says, Juan, go over there, you see there's a man over there, and they go take them. So I ran all the way, you know, across the street, the boulevard, and left, and screwed him, and put him in ours. And I remember one day I'm going up the stairs to our building, and one of the neighbors looked at me and says, Debbie, I saw you. And I was just terrified. I told my mom that this lady had seen me, and says, ignore her. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. You know. So it's like, okay. Shortly after that, I remember going to a supermarket, and, you know, we didn't have very much money at all. But I remember asking my mom for some batteries, and she didn't have any batteries. So I already knew, you don't ask. I needed batteries for a little toy. Well, I stuck them in my pocket and, you know, walked away with it. We get to the parking lot, I was so proud, I was going to tell my mom, I got the pilas, I got the batteries. My mom just had a fit. Literally dragged me by my ear and drove me all the way to the store and just put me in front of the store and made everybody. So So it'll listen up. My son just stole the batteries from you. And this is not, just gave me this whole lecture. And for me, I felt so betrayed. You know, I felt like this complete contradictory behaviors that were going on. It was like, what the fuck just happened? That was one of the moments where I just stopped trusting my mom. I just didn't know I could go there. Again, the rules changed. So I began to lose trust with her. Another time, you know, we grew up, of course, the first half of our family, or my life was with soccer. That's what my dad did, and all of this, until suddenly there's no more dad, and so now you gotta change heroes, you know? It's like, you can't talk about soccer, we're not gonna play soccer anymore, you're gonna do this, and so now we focus on my grandfather. My grandfather on the Mexican side, he was a very well-known and famous pioneer in aviation. Flew it from the very beginning and did all kinds of things. And again, so this is another bigger-than-life character that suddenly was like, wow, now... But he was also this was a rager, controlling person. Didn't drink, absolutely. He would not touch a drop because his father was an alcoholic. You know, he swung that pendulum hard. So I feared him a lot because when he raged, people would disappear. And I remember my other, you know, one of his other daughters, you know, my Victoria, she just didn't want to follow his rules. And he says, well, you're out of there. And I remember my dad, my grandfather, got so pissed that he took everything out of her room, kicked her out of the house, and made a big pile outside in the yard. And burned it in front of everybody. Just a full blown fire. And then at the end, he repainted the room and kind of hung this big crucifix on top of the bed. It's like, now cleanse and clean, and you'll never talk about Aunt Victoria again. So again, these are all things that I went on. And of course, now I'm terrified of, don't express your opinion, don't question this, don't do that. The shit could be, you know, just avoid conflict at all costs. Steal, just don't get caught. Cheat, have affairs, just don't get caught. The means are justified by the end. As long as the end benefits me, then it's okay to do it any way you can. So I learned to justify a lot of this, and this is what I grew up with. Jumping ahead into what it was as an adult, as I, you know, we came to the U.S. One of the character assets that I picked up along the way with all that moving, we learned to adapt very quickly. We thought we could come to the U.S. and just, you know, don't you just get across the border? And somehow my mom didn't get that memo or didn't know about that because we didn't have any papers and we didn't have, so we got stuck in Tijuana and we had to live there for a number of years, and then Mexicali and Ensenada and Rosarito. And all along my mom was just staying with a credit card that she had no funds for, just before computers. Until eventually she got caught and thrown into prison. During that time, it was probably about 8 months, we lived in hotels, from one hotel to the other, my brothers and sisters. And we'd not see my mom for days at a time. She'd be out there doing something. We still, to this day, don't know what she was doing to try to get money, whether it was prostitution or it was, don't think it was, but I don't rule it out. She did what she had to do to somehow get us there. And I'm not saying that this is part of how alcoholism is. This is just what, how a family is affected by the behaviors that get passed along, and not perhaps through genes, but this is just behaviors that get repeated. And they go all the way back and they just get repeated, and that's what she did. And she was just as stubborn as my grandfather did. She's gonna have it her way. And eventually we learned how to say US citizen really well. We learned how to dress like Americans, and we put on Walkmans, and we walked right up to the border with a bicycle, and we told them we were US citizens, and they waved us through, every one of us, one at a time, you know, my brothers and sisters. Eventually my mom got through the same way, and eventually we got to the U.S. and began to, you know, find jobs and whatever we could. Jumping ahead into probably, I would think relationships, girls. I had absolutely, well, I never had a father that taught me how to be a man, how to date, how to ask a girl, none of that. It was just, I would hear about it here and there. The examples of what it's like to have a relationship was, well, you have affairs, you cheat or you lie, just don't get caught. You say whatever you have to get what you need. And of course, that's what I did, that's what I tried. Once girls liked me, I had no idea what to do with that. And I remember just literally jump out the windows and just run because I didn't know what to do after that. So I didn't really have any relationships. I would meet him I'm a good looking guy and they were attracted to me and I could certainly play the role and lure them in and really play good. But after that, I had nothing else. And I remember just feeling that is just another thing that is wrong with me. Because I can't look, I'm good looking and I can do this, but I can't do the deal. And I began to really gather that evidence that I kept seeing from the get-go. You know, look, my dad abandoned me. I betrayed him. You know, nobody ever pays attention to me. And the time that I did, like, really just almost nagging that I get attention, it was received with just leave me fucking alone, you know, with a single mom that's got 40 other kids and there wasn't much to spare. So I had a pretty strong sense that I was not worth in love and I must not be good enough and nobody's got my back. And that all the things that I've done, they've kind of backfired and I don't feel very good about them. You know, I feel like, you know, I can't get a girl. I can't, you know, this is just how my upbringing was. When I turned about 19, I think 18 or 19, I met this girl that was 9 years older than me. She really liked me. She adored me. And she was the first one that I was like, okay. And I remember telling her my story. She was just more and more fascinated with me. And she totally fell in love with me. For me, it was like, please take me. First one that does. First one that really just, doesn't matter that she's almost 10 years older than me. And, you know, I have my reservations, but it's not important what I think. It's more important that she likes me and she's accepting me. And I've never had that. Let's run with it. We had a very good relationship that lasted 17 years. But out of the 17 years, I can tell you that the first 5 were amazing. The next 5, I remember realizing that I was missing out perhaps on a lot of things that I wanted to do, but don't even think about it because what would that do to her? Don't just stuff it down, don't let it out, don't say what you feel. And it was also for me a foot in the door that, you know, I know that this might not work out and I gotta be able to shut off those feelings if it is a hit, it's a fan, and I gotta go. So I stayed in the relationship longer. And then the last 5-6 years, I remember just really not wanting to be there, but thinking that if I tell her that I don't want to be there, it would be devastating for her. And I had this, you know, thing that I thought, you know, that there's no way that I could reveal this to her. I felt responsible for emotions, you know. And again, this is, I see things very differently today, but back then it was like, no way, there's no way I could ever tell her how I truly feel. So I just kind of went along with it and just stayed with it. And a lot of it was very good, and she gave me things that I needed, stability. I'm a true person that accepted me with all my flaws, and she put up with a lot of it. But I was only as capable of loving as I was capable. You know, I now see that, you know, it was pretty limited. I was only going to let people in this far because that's as much as I could with my background. That's what it was. Eventually, I remember just hinting around that I wasn't very happy. I was just like, yeah. I'm not happy. It's not you. But there's a few things that I wish could change. I don't know what, and it was a lot of that. And she would say, "What? Do you want to go to therapy?" "No, no, it's nothing that bad." But I just didn't have the vocabulary to say anything like that, to communicate what I was feeling. In fact, I didn't even know what I wanted. One of the things that I left out is, one of the things that got me attention growing up, and I remember the day it happened, was my mom was very artistic. My mom's an artist, and she was making little dough flowers, and I remember just copying them, and she kind of saw that there were more the next day, and the next day there were more, and she kept thinking, "How did this happen?" And then I kind of giggled, "That was me," and I remember her praising me for that. I was, "Man, you're so talented." Wow, I latched onto that and I never let go, I never looked back. From that moment forward, it was just all about, that's one way in which I can get attention. So I kept making things and I kept getting praises, and I would just, okay, well, now I'm done, we'll move on to the next and to the next, and I just have to keep doing more and more and more. And this has been, this is something that that has been with my whole life. I've been doing this since I was a very little kid. I've got a lot of skills in building things, a lot, in all kinds of areas, metal, models, you name it. I've picked them up along the way. In a lot of ways, it was a survival tool. It was a way to fit in, to be accepted. I got praised. I got better at it. It was one thing that fed my self-esteem. I did this. Nobody else was doing it. I was doing it, and it was getting me to feel better. I was also, when I was doing art, when I was in it, I was not thinking. I was just present doing that. And I began to sort of identify that it was safe to be there. So whenever the shit was hitting the fan or chaos was going on, the police getting called, this or that, I could always go and draw. I could always go and make this or do that. And it saved my life. I mean, I am very grateful for the influence that my mom gave me, and all of us in our family, we are all artists. Not one of them came out of that one without it, and we all make a living doing that. And I know it's had a very similar effect to all of us. I got into, between that and aviation in our family, I got into the aviation business, and I stayed with it for a long time, for 28 years. I learned how to fly hang gliders when hang gliding first started, and I stayed with it. And for me, it was just something that, I learned how to make them, how to fabricate them, and I was getting better. And there was always the bosses that I had. To me, they were idols. They were my dad. They were my grandfather. In one form or another, those characters were people that I looked up. The other interesting part about all of them, they were all dysfunctional, every single one of them, all my bosses. But yet, I was the perfect employee because I was practicing what I would learn at home, put on this veneer and do exactly, and I would scan them and I know what to do. And I was the perfect employee to do that, which is another one of those where I now see that it was one of those character traits that saved my ass. Really gave me a career, it taught me how to work, taught me so many skills. But at the same time, I was also getting lost because I was doing everything for either praise or to get your approval and to just, don't worry about what I'm feeling, I just need your approval. That was my whole mission in life, is just to get your approval. And when I was towards the end of the relationship with this gal that I was with, my partner in the business that I was in, which was, happens to also be the son of an alcoholic, and he was my best friend, committed suicide. Didn't know why. We just knew that he was under pressure, had a new baby, this and that, but it was just like, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I cried for about 15 minutes, and then afterwards I didn't feel a thing, because I was doing what I've always done, just stuff the feelings, just some things I couldn't say, and afterwards it was like, no, just stuff it down. And I, so I was, I kept using the same, the only tools that I had, that I'd learned along the way. And then the relationship that I was in just was, I finally said, I can't do this anymore. It's not working. I want out. But before you even said that, I started having an affair with a lady who is my wife now. I totally fell for her. She's got, she's so much like me. She's an artist. She does, her background is the same. But I too is, what was it called earlier? The dual?
Overlapping.
The overlapping relationship. Yeah, this overlapping relationship. And so now I'm just, you know, the shit sitting down with the relationship. I don't know where I'm at. I'm in love with this other woman. My best friend committed suicide. And my dad reaches out after 30 years. And all of this is just, this is what got me into program. My sister had told me about Al-Anon 4 years before. And, you know, we hear people say, you know, I wish I would have heard this, you know, when I was such and such. I heard about Al-Anon 4 years before that, but it's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. She would give me a newcomer's tag and I would stick it in the drawer, and then some months later I'd be telling her about this and that, and like, no, but she'd give me another one, and put it in the glove box. Like, I had more new, still to the day I have new newcomer tags, you know, very dated, all over the place. But I wasn't ready for it, I really wasn't. But eventually the pain was enough. The pain was enough to just go, I don't know what is going on. And then the dreams began to happen. Man, the dreams were kicking my ass. But the most powerful one is the one that, the day that I decided I need to get help. And I remember calling my sister and saying, I need help. And that evening, I remember having the most powerful dream I've ever had. And it was just one of those where I am the same one that I've always been. And I got it, and I see a bird up there. I know all about birds. You know, I fly with them, and like, it's a turkey vulture. And then you come down, and like, no, it's a bald eagle, and it's hurt. And pretty soon I realized, I don't know what it is, for one, I don't know what's going on, it needs help. Anyway, long story short, it was a very powerful dream that I remember, it was a turning point in me when I finally said, I need help, I can't do this alone. And Al-Anon's not for me, but I told my sister, why don't you give me your therapist's number? Since he already knows his family story, I can save some money because he will do it. And it'll help me quicker. So I started going to him and he didn't reveal anything. But it's the first time that I began to sort of open up about what had gone on. But I was in therapy until I ran out of money. And it was also when I was controlling what was going on, I only let him in as much as I wanted to let him in. And he was helping, he was able to help me as much as I was willing to help myself. I went broke and I was still in pain. And so finally I went to one meeting and I met Oscar. And he told me things that I had never heard that kind of clarity. He was just, I get it. No, 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 cabrón, it's así, así. And he was like, wow, but I'm not, what do I do? And he was like, and he says, man, come to the offsite next weekend. You know, what are you going to do? And literally for me, it was, I can go home and I'll cry my guts out as I've been for weeks and be in pain, or just follow what this guy said. And so I've been to three meetings. I went to the Barefoot, I think that's where I met you, or the Whitechapel. And then I went to an offsite with some guys with David Knox. And I went there a week into program, and everybody, and they talked about the steps, they worked the steps. The first meeting was step one and two and three, and then came the fourth step, and then the fifth step, and suddenly, and then I heard, you know, the guy that did the fifth step, he shared his story, and it was just like there's no way I could ever share that kind of stuff. I mean, the amount of secrets that I had and shame was just, there was no way. But I kept coming back, and now I knew that this program is about the steps. There I met a man that was doing the, Jack and Dave, and Tuesday night, and anyway, I met my sponsor there, a guy named Jack Jay from West Covina, and I began to talk to him, and lo and behold, you know, his mom was my mom. You know, and when he started talking about his mom and the, you know, the issues that he had with them and boundaries and just the crazy things, oh my God, he knows. And I kept talking and talking, and then I remember just 2 weeks into the program, I beat around the bush for about 20 minutes. And then I asked him, you know, could you possibly, you know, quit if you have some time? And if you're not doing anything else, you know, could you possibly help me with the steps? And he says, I'd be honored. And so we started this journey. He's still my sponsor to this day. And we began to work the steps. He had me write on what did the first step mean to me. You know, what was it that I, you know, what is it that I'm powerless over? He said, well, I got power over a lot of things. Almost everything I have power over. It's just one power. I'm fucking everything up, and I have no idea how to do it any different. What's the time?
So that's the number. You got 2 minutes.
Okay. So I began to, I wrote what my the first step was, and then I wrote what the second step was, and then he had me doing the third step. And then came the big, scary one that I was fearing. It was the fourth step. So I figured I could do this one, but without him. So I started it without him. And man, it kicked my ass. It was so scary. The amount of emotions that began to flood into me as I started to write just scared the lights out of me. And then it brought me to another threshold where I realized, no, this one you have to do. You will have to let somebody in. I was fearing what I was going to have to tell him. There was no way I was going to have to tell him all the shit that I had done. But that experience of trying to do it by myself scared me more. And I continued to have those dreams of being on a raft in the Grand Canyon under storm and shit that was like, okay, I'll follow his direction. And so I started the journey of the fourth step. And it took me 4 years to complete the fourth step. A lot of back and forth. And every time I would go to him and we'd read, he kept saying, now this is fantastic work, but I'd like you to now focus more on how did it make you feel. And, you know, when I first started reading it to him, he said, you know, you just, I've never heard a four step like this. And you read it as if you were just reading an article in a magazine. There was no emotion. Where is that? And so I began to realize, and what I had already known, that I was capable, like a crocodile, to just not shed a tear, stuff everything down and not get it out. And when I did my fourth step, my fifth step, you know, he said, I need to get further into this. And so he suggested I do some work with grief recovery. And we did a lot of very intense work specifically to deal with a lot of the events that went on. I had no idea that I had been abused, sexually abused. I had no idea. I thought this is what you have to do to make some money here or there. I accepted it as part of this is what you do when you're, you know. And there were so many, many, many other things that I was so skewed on my perception that my sponsor would just say, whoa, let's go back to this. How do you see this? I was like, no, it's not. Like, well, this is how I see it. Somebody like that should go to prison or this should be this. And I realized how skewed my perception was. And so I began to really learn what is more appropriate and what's not. And what I grew up in was not appropriate. There was a lot of great things, but there was a lot of really fucked up things. And so that process of the grief recovery work and the fourth and the fifth step was huge. The sixth and seventh, my character defects, that was painful too, because it was just, couldn't understand the step that it was written, but eventually I started realizing, you know, these are all the ways that I've made that are no longer serving me. And then here's the ones where have, and maybe they just kind of went awry, and I just didn't misuse them. And so I began to get a lot more clarity about my own talents, why I seek attention, And then, but I am pretty damn good and talented, and I do a lot of things. Again, it just, it's sort of like Al-Anon began to allow me to go back to the past and find all those pieces of the puzzle that I was too afraid to look at and sort of bring them to the light, see them for what it is, and then see like, oh shit, no wonder this here over here never fit, because this piece doesn't go there, this one doesn't, this one doesn't. And suddenly the puzzle really begins to take shape. And this analogy that I use because of the metaphor, because it's how it made me feel, that suddenly things begin to make sense. Getting to the eighth and the ninth step, I made a list of those people who had harmed. My ex was on the top of that list, my mom, my dad, myself. And I began the process of actually making direct amends. I reached out to my ex and made direct amends, but before so, I reached out to her and she was willing to do that. She asked me if that's what I was doing. Did I have my sponsor? Was I working the steps? Did I have my sponsor's blessing? And I said, yes, yes, and yes. And she said, all right, I'll meet you on Tuesday. And then we met and had all, it was very clear about what my part of it was, my 100% of my 50% of that relationship. And I was able to clear that up. I was able to clear up the relationship with my mom to a different level than I had. It's been a long journey. I was also able to make amends to my dad. Because at first I thought, I don't know anything to him. Well, it turns out I did. I had withheld my love from him for many years because I knew he was there. I just didn't want to talk to him. And I punished him by my passive-aggressive behavior, holding my love. And that's a tool that I use very commonly to punish my wife, to punish my kids, to punish those who I love. I just, well, yeah, well, I'm going to give you the cold shoulder. And I just, passive-aggressive, and this is how I communicate. It's what I learned. And growing up, and now I have to really make a strong effort at learning how to verbally, directly communicate, but I also need the wording because I don't have it in my own head. I don't have that kind of wording. I need my sponsor to tell me, how do I say this? How do I say that? How would you do it? Because I just don't have it. But through all of the process of those amends, my character defects and stop doing those that are no longer serving me, and then realizing those that are helping me are assets that I can continue. Just sifting through all these filters that Al-Anon giving me, the quality of my life in every area, with professionally, with family, with friends, have improved dramatically to a point where I had no idea. I came to Al-Anon to ease the pain. I just needed some relief. But what I ended up finding out is the manual that I never got from parents, and that helped me to deal with every situation. You know, you guys are my dads. You guys are my moms, my brothers. I've learned so much from everyone. And it's, I can't even express how much effect it's had on my life. And I'm sure I'll think of all the things that I'm missing today. But, you know, what I do feel today is great. I'm very grateful. It's gratitude. I married that girl that I had an affair with. She's in program with me. She works her program. She also works another program that is also benefited, the money program. She'd be okay for me sharing it. We've identified that, you know, well, I qualify for a lot of other programs. I know that I was, you know, but the main one is the one that keeps my emotions in check, and that's Al-Anon. I'm grateful that I have a partner that is also in program. We have a couples meeting that we hold at our house every month that helps us and other couples. That I'm grateful for all of that. I'm grateful for the two beautiful kids that I have that are giving me back my childhood. Everything that I missed, I'm getting back now through them. I'm identifying when I'm behaving like my parents did, and I can just stop and then go, whoa, you know, I'm totally squelching his spirit. Just like it was done to me, and I could sort of pick up that step and go, perhaps I can do it a different way. And so I'm recuperating stuff that I, again, I had no idea I was gonna get this. And that's just, you know, an amazing gift. And it keeps on giving. And that's what I get to just give back to you guys, is just tell my story and, you know, what went on. And so I'm gonna leave it at that. And is there any time left? I'm gonna leave it at that. And I'm so grateful to you guys that put this thing together and to ask me to come up and share. And I love you guys. Yeah. I don't know if anyone has any questions or wants to share before we move on. Go ahead.
You don't mind me asking. What happened to the college? Oh, sorry, George.
George. My dad, I met him. I went under my sponsor's direction and said, you know, I think there might be something there that you can look at. So I decided to go visit him in Africa. That's where he lived. Went a long journey, and we spent 2 weeks together in the Canary Islands. That's where he lived. And he stayed in there in the room where he set me up on the beach in this beautiful little apartment, and we just sat there and talked for 2 weeks. We got caught up with everything. From that moment on, we Skyped every single Sunday, and we talked about everything. He was an open book. He just said, I just hadn't been ready to do that. And he waited for all that time. And he was patient and loving. And that's all he did. When it was time for me, I finally did reach out to him. He passed away 2 years ago. But before that, I had the opportunity to talk to him and to directly and work with my sponsor to make sure that I had a clean slate, that I had cleared everything that I, if there was anything that I need to say, that I said it. If there's anything that I need to make amends, I did have that opportunity. And when he passed away 2 years ago, you know, I literally got to say goodbye to him on the way to the hospital, and he didn't come back. He died of emphysema. So that is another gift that COVID gave me, because I don't think I would have ever had the courage or the clarity or the opportunity to open up that book and to get to meet him.
Can I ask one more question? And your mom?
My mom, still alive, lives very close to me in Altadena. She's a very difficult woman, but I've learned a lot of tools in this program to stay away from the minefield. I've learned a lot of boundaries that I have to constantly share. I love what you shared yesterday. I totally identify with you. Because it's like, yeah, a lot of boundaries that I need to save with myself. I can't go there. And I also need to put a stop to her. And I say that I used to have this, you know, 10-foot wall, brick wall with my mom. Through the first amend process that I did, the ninth step with her, I brought down that wall to about 6 feet, and I actually put a gate. Meaning, I began to let her into my life. And now, after this last episode that we've had, where we had a big, it was a pretty powerful one, but I set a very strong boundary that I was not willing to participate in the crazy behavior she was asking me to do. And she said, well, fuck you, and I'm out of here. I had not done anything wrong. Eventually, she just kept ignoring me, but I was under my sponsors and therapists suggesting, they kept saying, just keep reaching out to her and letting her know that you love her. You did not intend to hurt her, but it is something that you needed to do. And I just kept doing this over and over, and eventually she got softer and softer and softer until eventually she said, all right, let's meet. And we met, and now she's back into our lives for the last 6 months, and she's been back to enjoying my grandkids. She's also gotten a life. She was so clingy, and you know, there was a lot of that emotional incest between my mom and I. I was her husband, I was her mentor, I was her companion, I was everything. And when I set that boundary, it shook the ground in ways that I hadn't really known until it happened. And my sponsor kept telling me, you just broke ground on the biggest issue that you've ever had, which is setting that boundary on the most important person in your life. And turns out, you know, now I'm starting to not have so much issues with setting boundaries with my bosses or coworkers or people that are very dominant that represent my mom. I'm so much easier now, like, I've been able to set that. And it's interesting that I guess this had to happen for that other thing to happen.
I'm David.
David.
You mentioned the woman who's almost in your building and you know about relationships. And what did you learn about relationships?
Yeah. I learned from her that it is okay to trust, even though I was only able to trust a certain point. For the first time in my life, I felt safe. But after that whole relationship, and again, all of the painful events that happened after in my life, I realized that honesty is something that I really got to work on, because I've been a chronic liar for most of my life. To manipulate, control, whatever. And in a relationship, that is something that I have to constantly maintain and try to be honest. And it's in honest way, in ways that it's not like I'm telling lies, it's just that I need to let her in. I need to let her in with my feelings, let her know how I feel. Otherwise, she's out there guessing. And I heard that from my ex a lot. When I made my amends, she said, man, I was always guessing what the hell was going on in your head. She told me that I was the best mistake she ever made. When it comes to relationship, then I wish I knew. I got so much more to go. But this is why I have that couples meeting in my house, because I need other couples. I need other people that show me how. Because we sometimes, again, my wife is also in the program, but we both also beat around the bush and we don't say what it is. And the reason we're all at each other's and we go passive aggressive, we do the same thing. And afterwards, now that we have program, it's kind of funny. We look at it afterwards and go, God, we got totally caught up into our own little things. And we kind of laugh about it. But we were both working on program. So I certainly don't have much experience when it comes to relationship, but I know where to go to get some. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Will. Guess we're going to have a 5-minute coffee break before our own Jack C is going to speak for us.